That's Mitt Romney conceding his defeat to President Obama tonight, speaking at his headquarters, his victory, it was supposed to be his victory party headquarters in Boston, with his wife Anne, and also with Paul Ryan and Paul Ryan's wife Jana on stage with him tonight. Mara Liasson is with us here. Mara, Mitt Romney gave the president a run for his money.
He did. He gave the president a run for his money. He also showed that he could perform when it mattered most. And I can't remember if it was James Carville or Bill Clinton who once said every candidate has to heave his campaign over the finish line. And I don't think Mitt Romney didn't heave it over the finish line, but he did elevate it when it was really in trouble. There was the moment before the debates when Republicans were despairing. And he turned in a great performance, and he gave his campaign a new lease on life. And it was close all the way up until the end. And you just heard him give an extremely gracious concession speech where he talked about the need to work together, to pray for the president's success, and to put aside partisanship. So he certainly ended it on a classy, in a classy way.
And, of course, we have NPR's Ari Shapiro in Boston. And, Ari, can you describe the mood there now?
People are, all of his family members, his five sons, their wives, the grandchildren, as well as Paul Ryan's family is all on stage. They're hugging. They're actually starting to walk off stage now. The crowd is chanting USA. It's been a really somber evening and a very long evening. I think people were sort of relieved to have some conclusion, even if it wasn't the conclusion that they were hoping for.
Let's also bring E.J. Dionne and Matt Canetti into the conversation. E.J., first to you. This was a man who was running, essentially had been running for president for about 7 years, a job he had been preparing for, a well-run campaign against a relatively popular, personally popular incumbent. What happens now? I mean, do you believe that Republicans will blame Mitt Romney? Does he become sort of what Michael Dukakis became to Democrats in 1988?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans would like to blame Mitt Romney. I think there are different parts of the party that want to do it for different reasons. Some hardcore conservatives will say, we told you all along that if we nominated a moderate, even though he didn't run as a moderate until the very end, if we nominate a moderate, we'll lose. So some of them will want to blame Mitt Romney. But I think the real problem that Romney had was that the voters could never figure out who he really was, because he ran pretty hard to the right in the primaries in order to win the nomination. And then only at the end did he start running as a moderate. It was hard to square those two people. I mean, that speech tonight was very gracious. And you wonder if he had tried to do that from the moment he won the nomination and talked about bipartisanship, if that would have worked differently.
Matt Continetti, I got to let you jump in there. I mean, do you see the same round of kind of hand-wringing and people looking at what went wrong for the party here?
But I mean, I would just say to E.J., I don't think the problem was so much the voters didn't understand Romney as the voters who came out to vote were not Romney supporters, and so there was no way really he could win in that type of contest. So that's the Republican problem. There's no way that if a Republican can just look at the numbers in 2008 and 2012 and see who's coming out on presidential elections and say that Republicans can win on a sustainable basis a national election in the future. I mean,
that's really saying the same thing, Matt. The Republicans act as if the entire country is the white South, basically, and that they've really run. I mean, you went to Romney rallies. This was a very monochromatic party, and they've got to reach out of that. And it was also a very old electorate. This is, you know, that they, if the, there's
yeah, but
a
look,
straight
John
line.
McCain supported the Bush-Kennedy immigration amnesty bill, and he lost big, too, in 2008. So
but he was
which
running,
is it?
But he was running in the middle of one of the worst economic downturns we had ever seen. I mean, the country had turned on President Bush. In this case, Barack Obama was presiding over an economy where the last unemployment number was 7.9% before the election.
But it's clear that both parties essentially consolidated the bases that they already have. They're boxing themselves in further. Mara, I mean, do you see sort of like a future path here in terms of this polarization? It seems like it's only getting deeper.
Well, I don't think the Democrats are boxing themselves in. I think they're riding the wave of a growing coalition that's only going to get bigger because they've got the demographic trends on their side. In terms of boxing themselves into a position in the standoff that we have in Washington, I think this election will cause some soul-searching, and not just on the part of the Republicans. I mean, President Obama has to decide how he wants to approach the big negotiations over taxes and entitlements and the deficit that we're going to have, and how much is he willing to compromise? Does he want to approach the Republicans in a different way? And the Republicans will also have to do some soul-searching. And I think, as we said before, immigration reform is a piece of legislation that I think has a lot better chance today than it did yesterday because of what happened tonight.
That's absolutely right.
Stay with us. We're going to be back in just a moment. You're listening to special coverage of Election Night 2012 here on NPR. And you can follow us online at npr.org.
You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. We just want to report one other district in New Hampshire. Democrat Carol Shea Porter in a rematch with Republican Frank Inta, the former Manchester mayor. It turns out that Carol Shea Porter has won that race in New Hampshire. Another one.
And, of course, now it's an all-female congressional delegation and a female governor in New Hampshire. I believe, fair to say, the first time a state has had an entirely female congressional delegation. We'll get back to some of those details in a moment. Let's turn to NPR's Howard Berkus, who is in Salt Lake City, Utah, of course, the epicenter of the Mormon Church in America. Howard, Mitt Romney would have been the first Mormon president of the United States. He was, of course, the first Mormon nominee of a major party. No small achievement in that sense.
No, that was a great achievement. And people I spoke with here at a gathering of Republicans who just watched Mitt Romney's concession speech, when I earlier in the evening, when they were still hoping that Mitt Romney would be the nominee, they talked about how this might help change the image of the Mormon Church, how his campaign really has already done that, how the fact that he was the nominee for the party indicated to them some acceptance of the Mormon faith by mainstream America, acceptance that has been elusive in the past. Of course, there were a lot of very sad faces here as Mitt Romney spoke. There were some tears in the room. People listened intently, applauded quietly. Despite other Republican gains in the state tonight, a lot of disappointment here.
Howard, I want to ask you about one congressional race that we've been following closely. Jim Matheson, the only Democrat in the House from Utah, running against Mia Love. She would be the first African-American Republican woman elected to Congress. What is the status of that race?
As the returns come in, and there are about 60% of the returns in, it gets closer and closer. Matheson has been leading in the returns all night. But now it's close to 2%, a little bit less than 2%. I asked Mia Love's people a little while ago what she was planning to do, and they said she's planning to sit tight until the final returns come in. It was expected to be this close. It's always a challenge for Jim Matheson to win in Utah. He's in a new district this year, a brand-new district, 4th Congressional District for the state. But it was the lines were drawn with as few Democrats as possible. The Republican legislature did that. It's always tough for him. He runs as a very conservative Democrat. But Mia Love is the rising star of the Republican Party, and she has excited a lot of people here. So it looks to be his toughest race so far in his 6 terms in Congress.
It's NPR's Howard Berkus reporting for us from Salt Lake City, Utah. Howard, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We turn now to NPR's Don Gagne, who is in Columbus, Ohio. Hi there, Don.
Hey, how you doing?
So talk a little bit about sort of how the storyline developed tonight. There was stark differences, obviously, in how the campaigns were presenting what might happen, and sort of what have you seen in the end?
You know, there might have been some anxiety in this room in Columbus, in this state that has become the center of the universe over the past few months or so of the campaign, but it always had a very kind of hopeful, even festive atmosphere, and it gradually built over the course of the evening as they watched Pennsylvania go into the Obama column, and Michigan, and Wisconsin, and these other states, and they could feel that Ohio was going to go, and then the TV screens ultimately, you know, flashed the big Obama victory in the entire election, and people here saw it as a payoff for the hard slog of a campaign that is all about organizing and the ground game and keeping your more than 100 field offices in place for 4 years. They feel like they really earned this one, and it was a tough battle. It really was.
And Don, you know, looking at the Midwest and sort of the support that President Obama was able to maintain there, I'm wondering if you could talk about whether or not the sort of politics over labor and all the big discussions that were happening in that region might have had an influence here.
I think all of that had a pretty big influence. And it started certainly with those battles in Ohio and Wisconsin 2 years ago about the stripping of public employee unions of certain collective bargaining rights. And that launched those huge protests, and it mobilized those people. And they didn't succeed in recalling Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin, but they did get the law repealed in Ohio. And that really kind of got the ground game going and kept the wheels oiled, if you will. And then the other big thing that we have to talk about, and it may have been even bigger, is the auto bailout. How strong the support was for it here, and how
obviously
easy
in Ohio,
it was.
Yeah, towards the end they talked about the Jeep ad that had come out that was very controversial.
Exactly, and it was so easy to go after Mitt Romney really, really hard on that because of that New York Times op-ed piece he penned back in 2008 that had the headline, Let Detroit Go Bankrupt. And he was always on the defensive on that, even as he tried to go on the offensive in recent weeks, but it just never got him any traction.
One other thing, Don, talk a little bit about Ohio 2010 versus 2012. I mean, did you sense some shifts there?
Certainly. You know, Governor Kasich was elected. There were five Ohio congressional seats that flipped from Democrat to Republican back in 2010, and there truly was a Republican wave that went across the state. Now, we had Sherrod Brown, the Democratic incumbent U.S. Senator, being reelected pretty handily tonight.
And someone who really adhered to the Obama campaign agenda, you know, and campaigned on it.
Exactly. I mean, he's an Obama Democrat, and he applauded the president every step of the way for the auto bailout, and he was with him on health care and everything else. And as strong of an Obama ally and surrogate as you could find, and he won handily, and the president, again, obviously did very well here. So the state's politics seem to have kind of moved to a different place. But the other thing is the state's unemployment rate is better than the national average. That's something Ohio's not used to. So when Governor Kasich would campaign with Mitt Romney and jump up on the stage first and say Ohio's on the way back, in some ways that was a little mini commercial for the Obama administration, even at a Romney event, and even though Governor Kasich wouldn't see it that way. But it is a very different atmosphere here in the state from what we saw 2 years ago.
That's NPR's Don Gagne in Ohio. Thanks so much, Don.
It's my pleasure.
On the line, we have Senator-elect Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin. Senator-elect Baldwin, first of all, congratulations to you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a very exciting night here in Wisconsin.
You spoke about being the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate from Wisconsin and also the first openly gay member of that august body. An historic night in Wisconsin, indeed.
Well, one of the things I said in my speech also was that I didn't run to make history. I ran to make a difference. And that's what we have to turn our attention to as the nation faces great challenges. But the fact that Wisconsinites did choose me to face those challenges is historic, and I'm very humbled tonight.
Senator-elect Baldwin, as you know, there still is the status quo remains on Capitol Hill. You will have a Republican-dominated House, a Senate narrowly controlled by Democrats and a Democrat in the White House. As you know, the American public very frustrated with gridlock between the White House and Capitol Hill. How will that change?
Well, one thing that will change is that we've passed through this election. And, you know, when we had leaders in the Senate 2 years ago say that one leader in particular, Mitch McConnell, say that his goal was to deprive the president of a second term and elevated that above doing the people's business, that was very difficult. But the election has now passed. Our president is going to have a second term, and that's not something that you can put in front anymore. So we have to come together and move forward.
Let's talk about immediate priorities for Democrats in the U.S. Senate. What are they? What do you expect to begin to work on the moment you arrive to the Senate?
Well, I think about the very consequential decisions that will be before the Congress in the first days and the first weeks of the next session. Obviously, we face issues of tackling our debt and deficit. We face issues of growing our economy, and we need to do so in a balanced way where everyone has a fair shot, but everyone does their fair share.
Let's talk a bit about the fiscal cliff, the looming deadline at the end of the year. What do you expect will happen?
Well, it's unclear to me, and we should hear in the next few days, whether the current leadership of the House and Senate will tackle this during the lame duck session or kick it off into the next session of Congress. But we know that the deadlines are looming, and I hope that we can come together and look at a balanced way to make sure that we're not harming our economic growth and the middle class as we face these challenges.
That's Wisconsin Senator-elect Tammy Baldwin, who defeated former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson in her bid to be elected to the U.S. Senate. Senator-elect, thank you so much. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
We turn now to NPR's Ken Rudin. And, Ken, we just heard someone that Harry Reid will be working with as a majority in the Senate. What about John Cornyn? The Texas Republican obviously seems like he had a rough night.
Well, he did have a rough night in the sense that 2 years ago, when the Republicans made some gains in that historic 2010 election, he said, no, this is going to be a two-cycle election to first to get to the majority. He looked at 2012. He saw that 33 Senate seats were up, 23 held by the Democrats. As a matter of fact, seven of the Democratic senators incumbents were retiring. So Cornyn and the Republicans said, look, 2012 is the good time, is the time we'll take back the majority. But a lot of problems. First of all, Dick Lugar losing in Indiana didn't help. The Tea Party and Richard Murdoch and Todd Akin, all those members of Congress, the Republicans who talked about God and abortion and rape, that didn't help. And then you had better Democratic candidates in many states. So it's not the kind of results they were hoping for.
Ken, thank you. You're listening to special coverage of Election Night 2012 from NPR News. We'll have analysis and more in just a little bit. From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2012. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Guy Raz. President Obama is expected to deliver a victory speech soon to supporters at McCormick Place in Chicago. He handily won re-election tonight by a margin of more than 30 electoral votes.
Governor Romney spoke to his supporters just about 30 minutes ago in downtown Boston.
I have just called President Obama to congratulate him on his victory. His supporters and his campaign also deserve congratulations. I wish all of them well, but particularly the President, the First Lady, and their daughters. This is a time of great challenges for America, and I pray that the President will be successful in guiding our nation.
Governor Romney thanked his running mate, Paul Ryan. He also thanked his family and his campaign team. Mr. Romney told his supporters, "I believe in America."
And I ran for office because I'm concerned about America. This election is over, but our principles endure. I believe that the principles upon which this nation was founded are the only sure guide to a resurgent economy and to renewed greatness. Like so many of you, Paul and I have left everything on the field. We have given our all to this campaign. I so wish that I had been able to fulfill your hopes to lead the country in a different direction, but the nation chose another leader, and so Ann and I join with you to earnestly pray for him and for this great nation. Thank you, and God bless America. You guys are the best. Thank you so much.
That's former Governor Mitt Romney conceding the presidency to Barack Obama.
Let's bring in E.J. Dionne and Matthew Connetti again for a bit more analysis. And Matt, I'd like to start with you. I can't help but think that the big loser tonight is money, the super PACs, who spent billions of dollars, particularly pro-GOP super PACs, to not only elect a Republican to the White House, but also a Republican majority to the U.S. Senate. They lost on both fronts.
In a lot of ways, this election reminds me of 2004, when you had a very an opposition base that was really angry and upset about the direction of the country, and they wanted to remove the incumbent president. And you also had a lot of money, outside money, in 2004. Remember, then it was
George Soros, right.
and his allies, Peter Lewis, the insurance magnate, and they spent a lot of money. In fact, Karl Rove says to this day that the Republicans were outspent when you add in all the outside money in 2004. And the incumbent won and, in fact, expanded his margins in the House and the Senate in 2004. And guess what? The exact same thing happened 8 years later, except now the incumbent's a Democrat and the agitated outside base are Republicans.
EJ, the fears over money in politics, overhyped?
I don't think they're overhyped. I agree with Matt that this does look a lot like 2004. There was a big debate at the beginning. Republicans were saying this was going to be like 1980 and Barack Obama was going to be Jimmy Carter. And the two problems with that were that Barack Obama wasn't Jimmy Carter and Mitt Romney wasn't Ronald Reagan. But the notion that the money didn't matter, Barack Obama managed to raise $1 billion. And the amount of money spent by the super PACs dwarfed anything that was done for the Democrats in 2004. And I think one of the things we're going to look at in terms of the money is what impact it may have had on some of these House races where a lot of money came in at the end. But I think there's something troubling about a small number of people having the capacity to spend all this money. But last thing is, I'm not sure the outside campaign was very well run. There was a cookie-cutter quality to a lot of the advertising put up by the anti-Obama super PACs. It turned out that probably the most consequential ads put up by super PACs were the attacks on Bain Capital by the Obama super PAC. They were controversial. They had less money behind them than the totality of the anti-Obama spending, but they had a real effect, particularly in Ohio.
Did the super PACs, Matthew Cottinetti, did for example, Crossroads, the Karl Rove super PAC, sort of lay the groundwork, the foundation for the next election?
No. I mean, who knows what the foundation for the next election will be. The Crossroads strategy was to target white women who had voted for Obama in 2008 and to convince them that Obama was a failure and it was time to let him go. And that failed. And so you know, is there going to be outside money? I don't think Citizens United is going away. I don't think that the margins in the Congress or in the Senate is going to allow Obama to pass a constitutional amendment or even tough legislative restrictions on campaign funding that would be the equivalent of a repeal of Citizens United. So I think this outlet is here to stay. And as you pointed out, and as EJ pointed out, Obama was just as good, if not better, at the Super PAC messaging and fundraising.
Matthew Continetti, EJ Dionne, stand by, and we're going to hear much more from you later on tonight.
We're turning now to NPR's Ina Jaffe, who's in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi there, Ina.
Hi, Audie.
And, of course, NPR has not yet projected the winner of the Nevada Senate race, but can you tell us a little bit about how close it's been with Shelley Berkley and Dean Heller?
Oh, boy. Right now, they are less than 0.25% apart.
Ah.
It could not be close. Well, I suppose it could literally be closer, but it's very close. And right now, Shelley Berkley is trailing. If you look at the map of the counties, right now the only county she is ahead in is Clark County, which is where Las Vegas is, which is the area that she has represented in the Congress for 7 terms. She has lost to Dean Heller, or is losing to Dean Heller, in every other county of the state, including Washoe County, and that is where Reno is. And President Obama took that county. But she is not doing the same thing. He is holding about a 7-point margin, which is larger than what the polls had predicted, over Mitt Romney. And apparently his coattails, even with the larger-than-expected margin, are not enough to really be pushing her over the top. At least it doesn't look like that's the case yet.
Ina, what does it say about this particular race and these candidates that it is so close, that so much outside spending came into the state over this race in particular?
Oh, about $20 million just on this one Senate race of outside money. The ads have been absolutely scorching. There is a lot on the issues that Shelley Berkley and the incumbent Dean Heller disagree on, but it hasn't been about that. It's been about she is corrupt and he is an enemy of women and old people, and it's really been just negativity straight across.
That's NPR's Ina Jaffe in Nevada. Ina, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to special coverage of Election Night 2012 from NPR News. We're going to have more analysis in just a little bit and recap of the night.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2012. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Audie Cornish. After more than a year of campaigning,
more than a million TV spots,
and roughly $6 billion spent, the 2012 elections are winding down.
And for all of that, the result was a resounding vote for the status quo. It's special coverage from NPR News.
We turn now to NPR's Ken Rudin and NPR's Ron Elving, and I just want to make a quick note about a race. John Tierney in the Massachusetts 6th District somehow pulled it out, despite all of the criticisms about his in-laws' like embezzlement scandal.
He was the Democrat who everyone thought was going to lose.
Yeah, so at least there was some kind of surprise, right?
Well, since 1996, we have not had a Republican in the House delegation in Massachusetts, and we haven't had a lot of Republicans in the Senate delegation either. In fact, the one who was there for the last couple of years, Scott Brown, was dismissed by the voters tonight. So Massachusetts is showing some preference for the Democratic Party, I would guess.
And no surprise here, Ron. We heard about this a couple minutes ago. Martin Heinrich has defeated Heather Wilson for the U.S. Senate seat from New Mexico.
That was not surprising. It was surprising in that it was not close. That had been thought to be one of the closest races in terms of matchup. Heather Wilson was the ideal candidate from the standpoint of the Republican Party. They were enormously happy to have her. And Martin Heinrich was not thought to be as well known in the state, but he proved to be the superior candidate, and in the end, that was not a tight race.
You know, you had two very good, strong Republican candidates, both Heather Wilson in New Mexico and Linda Lingle in Hawaii, but the demographics of those two states, the solid Obama win, the Latino vote in New Mexico, I mean, you could have great Republican candidates, but if the mood is against you, it's not gonna carry you to victory.
Also, looking at the House, Ken, it seemed like incumbents really just deeply entrenched, right? I mean, it looks like they didn't go anywhere.
That's true. And, of course, you know, we keep talking about all the billions, as you said, all the billions that were spent, and we're back to a status quo election. But there are some interesting things. Michelle Bachmann, for example, at this moment has a very, very slight lead in her chance for reelection in Minnesota. Alan West, the controversial Republican, a freshman from Florida, he's losing. He's trailing in his bid for a second term. So there are some, you know, incumbents who have had tough battles, but for the most part, I mean, if you look at the raw numbers, the net gain, it may be only Democrats one or two seats, but some incumbents had a really rough time of it.
Michelle Bachmann, I believe, spent among the highest of any House candidate for reelection.
She did, but she didn't really pay attention to the race until late in the campaign. A lot of Republicans were saying, look, you know, this is a tough race for you. There was a lot of resentment over your presidential race. You got to pay more attention, and she finally did, but towards the end.
Meanwhile, for Alan West, of course, he's someone who's been a sort of marquee player for Tea Party backed Republicans in the House. But overall, what did we learn about sort of where the Tea Party sort of power is across the country?
You know, the Tea Party is already out there saying that they were powering wins for the Republican Party in the House, not saying so much about the Senate, because some of the candidates that they favored probably hurt the Republican Party's overall chances today. But they have been taking credit for saving a lot of the candidates who were signed up with their program in 2010. This was not a Tea Party election, of course, like 2010 was. But then, on the other hand, it was an election in which a lot of the people who won in 2010 successfully defended their seats. We're only going to see single-digit gains for the Democrats in the House if they even make those.
Yeah, there was a question whether there'd be a lot of one-hit wonders, and it turns out that's not quite the case.
Well, at least there are two-hit wonders. They're going to be around for at least one more
term. Redistricting had a lot to do with that. Redistricting a lot of those states where the Republicans controlled the state legislatures and the governors, especially states like North Carolina, they saved a lot of Republicans who may have been very vulnerable for 2012. But at the same time, you could look at the Democrats who won in Illinois. I think three or four Republican incumbents went down to defeat, and that was because of Democratic redistricting.
It'll be interesting to look at California, where redistricting was done by an independent commission, to see if there's sort of some difference playing out there.
That's right, and that's probably going to be a little disappointing to the Democrats, who would hope they could pick up quite a number of seats in that state that has so many congressional districts. They won't get as many as they had hoped for. But redistricting is a double-edged sword. That's probably one of the reasons why Alan West might lose tonight, is because the district he's in now is not the district he was originally
Although he,
elected
no, he actually
in.
Moved to a
he
more
moved to another
that
was a better
district,
Republican district, but it wasn't the one that had elected him 2 years ago, so it's not even strictly speaking a true re-election.
I know we're watching the election in North Dakota closely. Heidi Heitkamp is running neck and neck with Rick Berg. Any other potential surprises to expect before the night is over?
Well, surprises to expect. Shelley Berkley and Dean Heller are also very, very close. Shelley Berkley was probably not considered to be that big a threat to Dean Heller.
For the Senate seat in Nevada.
That's right. And he, of course, is not really an elected incumbent. He got into the seat because of John Ensign's retirement.
Well, Ron, stand by. We'll have more from you and from Ken in a moment. You're listening to special coverage of Election Night 2012 here on NPR. You can also visit our website, npr.org, for full analysis, results, and more. Stay with us. From NPR News, this is special coverage of Election Night 2012. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Audie Cornish. President Obama has swept to a re-election victory over Republican challenger Mitt Romney.
The president posted wins in the battleground states of Virginia, Ohio, New Hampshire, Colorado, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Nevada.
And the contest for Florida remains too close to call, with Mr. Obama holding a narrow lead over Governor Romney. And actually, we see President Obama coming onto the stage right now with his family, waving to the crowd. And he is at the headquarters in Chicago, Illinois.
Chicago, Illinois. There's President Obama with Sasha Malia and, of course, Michelle Obama. And the crowd is going wild. Of course, Stevie Wonder is
the sign, seal, deliver. Echoing in our heads if you follow these campaigns at all.
Become the president's theme song. And a very obviously enthusiastic crowd behind him and in front of him. It looks like there are tens of thousands of people there in Chicago tonight. The president soaking it in. He has won, and it appears as if he has won handily.
Yes, he has, and it'll be interesting to hear what the speech has in store. We heard Mitt Romney in his concession earlier, which was short but sweet, essentially calling for support of his president, saying he would pray for President Barack Obama and his family.
And he may need those prayers because this will be a tough second
term. It's going to be a rough couple of months alone, right, just going into
the next year. The fiscal cliff coming. And he's got a Republican-dominated House that he has to contend with. And
a very slim majority in the Senate.
And many Republicans who will demand the president make some very, very serious compromises on taxes, on deficit reduction, and so on.
And President Obama still on stage getting ready to give his victory speech, take a victory lap, it looks like.
And this really does remind you of that night in Chicago 4 years ago. Obviously, a slightly different mood.
Not as intense with the fireworks and crying faces.
And the weeping and the crying, but yeah. Still an enthusiastic crowd. There are a very big crowd there in Chicago. The president, he has pulled it off. His campaign has pulled it off, and here he is. Let's listen in.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Tonight, more than 200 years after a former colony won the right to determine its own destiny, the task of perfecting our union moves forward. It moves forward because of you. It moves forward because you reaffirmed the spirit that has triumphed over war and depression, the spirit that has lifted this country from the depths of despair to the great heights of hope, the belief that while each of us will pursue our own individual dreams, we are an American family, and we rise or fall together as one nation and as one people. Tonight, in this election, you, the American people, reminded us that while our road has been hard, while our journey has been long, we have picked ourselves up, we have fought our way back, and we know in our hearts that for the United States of America, the best is yet to come. I want to thank every American who participated in this election. Whether you voted for the very first time or waited in line for a very long time, By the way, we have to fix that. Whether you pounded the pavement or picked up the phone. Whether you held an Obama sign or a Romney sign, you made your voice heard, and you made a difference. I just spoke with Governor Romney, and I congratulated him and Paul Ryan on a hard-fought campaign. We may have battled fiercely, but it's only because we love this country deeply, and we care so strongly about its future. From George to Lenore to their son, Mitt, the Romney family has chosen to give back to America through public service, and that is a legacy that we honor and applaud tonight. In the weeks ahead, I also look forward to sitting down with Governor Romney to talk about where we can work together to move this country forward. I want to thank my friend and partner of the last 4 years, America's happy warrior, the best vice president anybody could ever hope for, Joe Biden. And I wouldn't be the man I am today without the woman who agreed to marry me 20 years ago. Let me say this publicly. Michelle, I have never loved you more. I have never been prouder to watch the rest of America fall in love with you, too, as our nation's first lady. Sasha and Malia, before our very eyes, you're growing up to become two strong, smart, beautiful young women, just like your mom. And I'm so proud of you guys. But I will say that for now, one dog's probably enough. To the best campaign team and volunteers in the history of politics. The best. The best ever. Some of you were new this time around, and some of you have been at my side since the very beginning. But all of you are family. No matter what you do or where you go from here, you will carry the memory of the history we made together. And you will have the lifelong appreciation of a grateful president. Thank you for believing all the way. Through every hill, through every valley. You lifted me up the whole way, and I will always be grateful for everything that you've done and all the incredible work that you've put in. I know that political campaigns can sometimes seem small, even silly. And that provides plenty of fodder for the cynics who tell us that politics is nothing more than a contest of egos or the domain of special interests. But if you ever get the chance to talk to folks who turned out at our rallies and crowded along a rope line in a high school gym, or saw folks working late at a campaign office in some tiny county far away from home, you'll discover something else. You'll hear the determination in the voice of a young field organizer who's working his way through college and wants to make sure every child has that same opportunity. You'll hear the pride in the voice of a volunteer who's going door to door because her brother was finally hired when the local auto plant added another shift. You'll hear the deep patriotism in the voice of a military spouse who's working the phones late at night to make sure that no one who fights for this country ever has to fight for a job or a roof over their head when they come home. That's why we do this. That's what politics can be. That's why elections matter. It's not small, it's big. It's important. Democracy in a nation of 300 million can be noisy and messy and complicated. We have our own opinions. Each of us has deeply held beliefs. And when we go through tough times, when we make big decisions as a country, it necessarily stirs passions, stirs up controversy. That won't change after tonight, and it shouldn't. These arguments we have are a mark of our liberty. And we can never forget that as we speak, people in distant nations are risking their lives right now just for a chance to argue about the issues that matter. The chance to cast their ballots like we did today. But despite all our differences, most of us share certain hopes for America's future. We want our kids to grow up in a country where they have access to the best schools and the best teachers. A country that lives up to its legacy as the global leader in technology and discovery and innovation, with all the good jobs and new businesses that follow. We want our children to live in America that isn't burdened by debt, that isn't weakened by inequality, that isn't threatened by the destructive power of a warming planet. We want to pass on a country that's safe and respected and admired around the world, a nation that is defended by the strongest military on earth and the best troops this world has ever known. But also a country that moves with confidence beyond this time of war to shape a peace that is built on the promise of freedom and dignity for every human being. We believe in a generous America, in a compassionate America, in a tolerant America, open to the dreams of an immigrant's daughter who studies in our schools and pledges to our flag. To the young boy on the south side of Chicago who sees a life beyond the nearest street corner. To the furniture worker's child in North Carolina who wants to become a doctor or a scientist, an engineer or an entrepreneur, a diplomat or even a president. That's the future we hope for. That's the vision we share. That's where we need to go. Forward. That's where we need to go. Now, we will disagree, sometimes fiercely, about how to get there. As it has for more than two centuries, progress will come in fits and starts. It's not always a straight line. It's not always a smooth path. By itself, the recognition that we have common hopes and dreams won't end all the gridlock or solve all our problems. or substitute for the painstaking work of building consensus and making the difficult compromises needed to move this country forward. But that common bond is where we must begin. Our economy is recovering. A decade of war is ending. A long campaign is now over. And whether I earned your vote or not, I have listened to you. I have learned from you. And you've made me a better president. And with your stories and your struggles, I return to the White House more determined and more inspired than ever about the work there is to do and the future that lies ahead. Tonight, you voted for action, not politics as usual. You elected us to focus on your jobs, not ours. And in the coming weeks and months, I am looking forward to reaching out and working with leaders of both parties to meet the challenges we can only solve together, reducing our deficit, reforming our tax code, fixing our immigration system, freeing ourselves from foreign oil. We've got more work to do. But that doesn't mean your work is done. The role of citizen in our democracy does not end with your vote. America's never been about what can be done for us. It's about what can be done by us together through the hard and frustrating but necessary work of self-government. That's the principle we were founded on. This country has more wealth than any nation, but that's not what makes us rich. We have the most powerful military in history, but that's not what makes us strong. Diversity, our culture, are all the envy of the world, but that's not what keeps the world coming to our shores. What makes America exceptional are the bonds that hold together the most diverse nation on earth. The belief that our destiny is shared, that this country only works when we accept certain obligations to one another and the future generations, so that the freedom which so many Americans have fought for and died for comes with responsibilities as well as rights, and among those are love and charity and duty and patriotism. That's what makes America great. I am hopeful tonight because I've seen the spirit at work in America. I've seen it in the family business whose owners would rather cut their own pay than lay off their neighbors, and in the workers who would rather cut back their hours than see a friend lose a job. I've seen it in the soldiers who re-enlist after losing a limb, and in those SEALs who charged up the stairs into darkness and danger because they knew there was a buddy behind them watching their back. I've seen it on the shores of New Jersey and New York, where leaders from every party and level of government have swept aside their differences to help a community rebuild from the wreckage of a terrible storm. And I saw it just the other day in Mentor, Ohio, where a father told the story of his 8-year-old daughter, whose long battle with leukemia nearly cost their family everything. Had it not been for health care reform passing just a few months before the insurance company was about to stop paying for her care.
I had an opportunity to not just talk to the father, but meet this incredible daughter of his. And when he spoke to the crowd, listening to that father's story, every parent in that room had tears in their eyes. Because we knew that little girl could be our own. And I know that every American wants her future to be just as bright. That's who we are. That's the country I'm so proud to lead as your president. And tonight, despite all the hardship we've been through, despite all the frustrations of Washington, I've never been more hopeful about our future. I have never been more hopeful about America. And I ask you to sustain that hope. I'm not talking about blind optimism, the kind of hope that just ignores the enormity of the tasks ahead or the roadblocks that stand in our path. I'm not talking about the wishful idealism that allows us to just sit on the sidelines or shirk from a fight. I have always believed that hope is that stubborn thing inside us that insists, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that something better awaits us, so long as we have the courage to keep reaching, to keep working, to keep fighting. America, I believe we can build on the progress we've made and continue to fight for new jobs and new opportunity and new security for the middle class. I believe we can keep the promise of our founding, the idea that if you're willing to work hard, it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from or what you look like or where you love. It doesn't matter whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Asian or Native American or young or old or rich or poor, able, disabled, gay or straight. You can make it here in America if you're willing to try. I believe we can seize this future together because we are not as divided as our politics suggests. We're not as cynical as the pundits believe. We are greater than the sum of our individual ambitions, and we remain more than a collection of red states and blue states. We are and forever will be the United States of America. And together, with your help and God's grace, we will continue our journey forward and remind the world just why it is that we live in the greatest nation on earth. Thank you, America. God bless you. God bless these United States.
That's President Barack Obama with a victory speech. Speaking in Chicago, the president projected to take 303 electoral college votes, well over the 270 he needed to win. The president captured many of the battleground states that he was able to in 2008, including Colorado, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nevada. A lot of redefining of hope in this speech. NPR's Mara Liasson, can you talk to us about what we were hearing there? It sounded like he was gearing up for the next round of battles.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but he did end with a reprise of the speech that really brought him on the national scene, the 2004 speech at the Democratic Convention. We're not a collection of red states and blue states. We are the United States. But I thought it was a speech to really a movement of his supporters that was mature, that grounded out even without the phenomenal wave of hope and change and the romanticism of the first run. And I think he talked about sitting down with Governor Romney. Now, I don't think I can remember a time when a president said, I want to sit down and talk to the opponent I just vanquished.
Although you could have watched this speech on MittRomney.com, where there was a live stream to the President Obama's victory speech.
And he did mention we're going to tackle these problems. He talked about it. We don't want to be a country burdened by debt or inequality or a warming planet. And he talked about tax reform and the deficit and immigration reform. He did talk about an agenda, and he said it's going to be take hard, the hard, painstaking work of compromise. We're not to build a consensus. And I think that he's preparing people for the next tasks.